If you've ever watched one of those films about Henry VIII as a young man, what strikes you is not the king we remember. It's the man we've almost completely forgotten. Because the man we remember often comes from that portrait of a very large, immobile figure. When he was young, he was strapping, athletic. It was described that he would chase stags through the forest because he loved the pursuit. He loved games, he loved movement, he loved showing what he can do. He was the Renaissance prince. He spoke multiple languages, was well-read, he was musical, and he had that Grecian quality where mind and body were not separate things, but the same expression. Now, if you look at his early armor, and armor doesn't lie, you can see it. A very narrow waist, broad shoulders, clearly built for motion. This was not a man drifting into indulgence. This was a man very much in control of himself. And then, in a single moment, that began to change. Today, we will be making sense of the madness of King Henry VIII. I am your chief medical explanationist, Dr. Terry Simpson, and this is ForkU, Fork University, where we make sense of the madness, bust a few myths, and teach you a little bit about food and medicine. It was January 1536. And the king is thrown from a horse during a jousting match, and the horse came down on him in a ditch. The king was reportedly unconscious for at least 2 hours, long enough that most people felt this king would not survive. This was not a minor event. This was major brain injury. And what follows, very quickly after that incident, starting in May, Anne Boleyn is arrested, his second wife, accused of adultery, incest, and witchcraft. Witchcraft. This from a man who, prior to this, was not particularly inclined toward superstition. This was a Renaissance king. Now perhaps it was for the masses, or perhaps something else had changed. Because he could have divorced her. He had done that before. Instead, he had Anne Boleyn executed. And around that same time, his body began to change. So when you look at Henry across time, the change is hard to ignore. The early Henry, the one before 1530s, was charismatic, athletic, generous, even warm. Still capable of ruthlessness, yes, but not unpredictably so. And then, after that period, the description shifted. He was described as being volatile, prone to sudden rage, vindictive, a very short fuse, suspicion, paranoid. You saw it with Anne Boleyn. You saw it when he tried to handle different rebellions. You saw how, when he turned to those who were once closest to them, sending the tower. And the timing of that change is, well, it's interesting. Now, to be fair, not everyone agrees why, because Henry's life was already complicated. He had broken with Rome. There were the religious tensions as he was forming his new religion. There were political factions. And there was chronic pain from those leg ulcers. And over the years, people have proposed all sorts of explanations. Endocrine disease, metabolic disease, rare genetic syndromes. You know, medicine historically never gives you one clean answer. It gives you a stack of imperfect ones and you learn to recognize the pattern. But here's what's hard to ignore. The clustering. The proximity to the injury in January of 1536, combined with the behavioral changes and appetite changes, all in the same window. Now, it may not explain everything, but explains too much to ignore. Now, when we say this is happening in his brain, we should be very precise about what that means, because there is a very specific structure in the brain at the center of this story. It's called the hypothalamus. It's small, it's about the size of a walnut, buried deep, but absolutely central to survival. The hypothalamus regulates appetite, satiety, energy balance, stress, hormonal signaling. Essentially, it decides whether you eat, when you stop, and how your body interprets the world around you. It keeps you breathing. And when that system works, you don't notice it. It just goes on without you. You eat, you get full, you stop. Quietly. Automatically. But when the system is disrupted, whether by environment, by chronic metabolic stress, or very clearly by trauma, the entire experience of eating changes. Not philosophically, but physiologically. Because traumatic brain injury can damage the hypothalamus directly or indirectly through swelling, vascular injury, pressure. And when that happens, you can develop something we now call acquired hypothalamic obesity. That's not a lifestyle problem. It's a neurologic problem. And now this isn't theoretical. We see this in modern data. A significant portion of patients who have traumatic brain injury gain weight over time. And the strongest predictor is not inactivity, it's hyperphagia, meaning eating fast and a lot. The problem isn't how much they move. It's what their brain is telling them to do. And when you look at the mechanism, it becomes even more interesting. Because within the hypothalamus, you have regions like the arcuate nucleus and the ventromedial hypothalamus, structures that regulate satiety through neuropeptides, through signaling systems that quietly govern your appetite every day. And trauma can disrupt those systems. It changes the signal, even the alters the expression of that. So the signal that once told you you're full no longer arrives, or arrives too late, or is drowned out. And the hypothalamus doesn't work alone. It's connected to the pituitary, to the adrenal system, to stress pathways. So when it's disrupted, you don't just see changes in eating. You see changes in mood, in impulsiveness, in stress, how you manage stress, which begins to sound very familiar. When the hypothalamus is injured, hunger stops being a signal and it becomes a drive. Now, if the old explanation that happened around King Henry VIII was math, it should work, right? It doesn't. You don't gain 200 pounds simply because you stop exercising. We measure activity in metabolic units. And even a large drop of activity doesn't explain that magnitude of change. You can't outrun math. And yet, every January, gyms fill up with people told exactly that. Move more, burn it off, try harder. And every February, those gyms empty out. If exercise alone fixed obesity, January would cure it every year. But it doesn't. Because the problem isn't movement. The problem is signal. Now, I have seen this before. I've worked with former National Football League players, men who trained at the highest level and later became morbidly obese. The explanation didn't fit, because not all of them gained weight, but the ones who did had significant histories of concussions. Now, these were concussions that involved unconsciousness, not just they had their bells rung. And when you talk to them, they didn't describe weakness, they described something else. Food noise, constant, relentless. Now, I'll tell you something. For years, I heard patients describe this until I understood it, and I guess I understood it intellectually, but I really didn't understand it until 12 hours after I injected myself with Zepbound, the GLP-1 agonist, also called tirzepatide or Mounjaro. 12 hours later, the world went quiet. Something in my head just calmed down, something I didn't even know was there. And for the first time in my life, I understood what they meant. Not hunger, noise. And suddenly it was gone. Now, I've lost 50 pounds since then, and I'm quite happy about that. But what's fascinating is what happened as it wears off. A day or two before my next injection, that food noise starts creeping back in, kind of whispering, telling me there's ice cream in the freezer, maybe I should stop somewhere and pick up some dessert, food moves a little faster, my stress goes up on my Whoop, and then a few hours after I inject, it disappears again, just like that. And you realize hunger wasn't about the stomach. Now I want you to imagine Henry VIII. He has the same signal, but he's king. Nobody tells him no. If he wants a feast, he gets it. And today, you have food noise and access. You can summon a meal in minutes. You can be full and still eat, because fullness and noise are not the same thing. And we do have some contemporaneous observation. A French ambassador in 1540 noted that Henry's leg problems troubled him often and that he compensated by eating and drinking more. Now, that's interesting because even then, people were linking pain, behavior, and appetite and mood. And later, reconstruction suggests that large quantity of food, ale, and wine. Now, to be fair, those are reconstructions, but even if the numbers were off, the direction is not. We may not know exactly how much he ate, but we know something was driving it. And by the end of his life, Henry could barely move. They developed devices to help him stand, to move. He lost his friends. Mostly he had them executed, Thomas Wolsey, Thomas More. And when he died, his body was so large his coffin reportedly ruptured. That was the decline of King Henry VIII. Now, GLP-1 doesn't create discipline. It does restore control. It quiets the signal. It even changes things like alcohol intake. I, for example, drink way less. I don't even finish a glass of wine anymore. GLP-1 doesn't really cure obesity. It corrects the signal that made it inevitable. When we look at Henry VIII through these eyes, we see that he fits what we call traumatic hypothalamic syndrome. That he didn't just gain weight because he stopped moving. But the signal in his brain changed, and he all of a sudden had food noise. and he had food noise and the presence of abundant foods. We probably misinterpreted and misunderstood him for a long time, saying it was calories in and calories out. But when you ignore the biology, you don't just miss the disease, but you can blame yourself or the patient for handling it. This episode was researched and written by me, Dr. Terry Simpson, and while I am a physician, I am not your physician. If you're making any changes to your diet or exercise routine, please see your personal physician, board certified, not a chiropractor, not a fundamental integrative witch doctor, and a registered dietitian would be good also, because there are some diseases for which diet makes a big difference. All Things Audio were done by our friends at Simpler Media and the pod god himself, Mr. Evo Terra. Producer Girl makes me better sounding than I really am in person and in life. And finally, for references and more information about this, please see this on yourdoctorsorders.com, forq.com, and I also have some notes about this in my Substack at drsimpson.com. All right, everybody, have a good week. Hey, Evo, imagine this. King Henry VIII had access to Zepbound or Ozempic. History might have been a little different. Maybe Anne would not have lost her head.
Come for the medical advice, stay for the history lesson, I guess. Hey, does that also explain Fetterman?